Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. What I would like to do is kick it off with something not a lot of people talk about. And that is what happens when you are the sponsor or a GP of a project and something goes bad, something goes wrong, something happens that is unexpected. And if you have no investors, well, you have a different set of problems and you have a different set of considerations. But if you've raised money from other people and something goes wrong or something goes different from the way that you planned it, the way that you expected it to go, how do you articulate that to investors and how do you deal with problems? In the hotel world, there is a million different problems that can arise. In fact, 75% of my day is dealing with problems on the operational side. If you're under construction, all of your time is going to be spent dealing with problems on the construction side. But once you're opened, you're going to be focused on dealing with problems on the operational side. So you get sued all the time, either from your guests, maybe from your employees, and you could be running into issues with the city. You could be running into an issue with your investors. You could be running into an issue with your lender. You'd be running into a national disaster. We built the Moxie Hotel in St. Pete. That hotel opened 6 weeks ago, and we've had two hurricanes since that hotel opened. And luckily, we were one of the only hotels in St. Pete that could remain open during the hurricane. We're like not directly on the water. We're kind of at like this high point between the bay here and the ocean here. So we're at like 40 feet above elevation. So I was concerned that we might actually be the only hotel left in St. Pete after this last hurricane. But luckily, the devastation was bad, but not too bad. Our hotel had very little damage, which was great. We definitely had an impact because we didn't have any power. We didn't have any water. We didn't have any internet for like 2 days. We got the water back the second day, and then the power came back like the third day. So the hotel ended up performing very well because we were sold out, but all of that takes planning and preparation.
In this instance, not a lot of things went bad. In fact, things went very well for us. The team performed amazingly. We have these like hurricane preparedness plans, but it could have gone bad. So one of the first things that we did once we realized what was happening and we got a handle on the situation, we email our investors and say, hey, this new hotel that you guys helped fund and that you invested so much money in is still standing. Oh, and by the way, we did a ton of business. We're going to beat budget probably by like 50%. We didn't tell them that part. We'll tell them that later. But the hotel is still standing. Everyone's okay. And, you know, rest easy. So that was a good one. An example of a bad one is during COVID, when we had to like shut down our hotels right at the beginning, when business essentially evaporated, there was no more business. I was communicating with my investors probably every 2 weeks, and I would send a letter to them. And I'd be very upfront, very honest. So my recommendation for every problem, every issue that arises, is to come out and hit it head on. Do not wait. Do not equivocate. Once you figure out what you're doing and what the best plan forward is, tell your investors, tell the people that matter. Obviously, if like there's an issue with the counterparty, don't tell them what your strategy is. But the people that backed you, the people that invested with you, your partners, come out and tell them. Do not hide shit. Tell them everything, because it will come out in the end. So just tell them everything from the start. What I don't recommend, though, you do is tell them half truths or theories, ideas, concerns, because it might just build and build and build for no good reason. So when you know something, when you have solid information, let people know. If you think things are going in a direction and you have a lot of probability that it's going to head that way, let people know. The best way to tell someone bad news is to come right out and tell them the bad news right off the top, because it's like, boom, it's like getting a shot. You got the shot, it's all over, it's done. And then it's potentially easier from there on. There's a lot of people like in the downturn when interest rates started to rise, like all these, you know, multifamily operators and these syndicators seem to like be running into a lot of problems with their investors. And if you really like started to double click on a lot of those issues, it was because they were doing bad things. They were like lying to their investors. They were misappropriating money. You should never do any of that. But a lot of those things would have never happened. They probably wouldn't have lost their businesses if they just came right out and told investors what the issues were. Because in some cases, your investors might help you. In some cases, you might not want their help. They should just know. But in many cases, it's good when you tell people things. And this applies to your partners or your investors. So I thought I would share some of the experiences I've had in telling people bad news, good news, everything. During COVID, you know, I used to give these like webinars because we have like a lot of investors. So I just come on and tell people what we're doing, what the updates are. And we get like a ton of questions, and you get a lot of challenging questions, but that's about being in business. That's about being a boss. That's about being a CEO. You've got to hit things head on, and you've got to be the one willing to make a decision. If there's a decision that requires the input from your partner, your capital partner, your investor, include them in the decision, but come right out and be able to make a decision. That is something very key. I thought it was like relevant to just kick it off. If you have questions that are completely unrelated to this, great. I just wanted to share something that was kind of going on generally, I think, in real estate, because there's a lot of turmoil in capital markets and people have problems. And the biggest advice and the biggest feedback I got during COVID was to make sure we were open and honest and direct with everyone. So I wanted to share that with you guys. Hopefully that's helpful for anything that you're doing in business or life. But let's kick it off with some Q&A.
So I'm Eddie. I'm in Maine. I have a 10-unit micro resort, and I'm looking to expand. And so my question is, for your operating company versus property company, how are you setting that up? So if I, if I buy another location, it's probably not something I own. So there'll be a different ownership structure. So I'm curious where I know that you have properties that are owned with investors. How are you doing the operating company versus property company? And do you have any vendors that you would recommend? Lawyers, bookkeepers, accountants, that sort of thing?
This is a great question because real estate is very complicated. And I think a lot of people get in trouble with bad structures. Hotels are even more complicated above real estate because you have an operating business, which is like the hotel, and you also have the real estate business. So I'll tell you how we set it up, which as we found is very common with how a lot of other big players set up, but it's not like a big person, small thing. It's you should do this too. So let's just talk about the specific property in general, and then I'll like go into maybe some like bigger company stuff. But first off, where in Maine is your place? What's it called?
It's called Get Together Stays. We're about 45 minutes from Acadia National Park, so in the Bar Harbor region.
That's awesome. I went to Kennebunkport this summer. I'm very bullish on Maine travel. So
I for think sure. Very Likewise.
Cool, I think it's a very cool place to be. So, okay. Basic structure. Your real estate is owned by an LLC. Let's just, you know, you own a hotel on 123 Maple Street. So your real estate entity is 123 Maple Street LLC. That maybe is owned directly or indirectly. You could put another LLC in there by whoever the owners are. You, your investors, whatever that is. And that's kind of it. That's the very simple structure of real estate. And each hotel or each property that you own should have a separate LLC so that you don't cross-collateralize them. The operating business can be done in two ways. You can have like a fake lease, kind of like a lease, like we're going to lease the real estate to the operating company for like a dollar a year. And that's going to be called 123 Maple Street Operations LLC. And that is the company that's going to run the hotel, that's going to hire the employees, that's going to, you know, buy all the food, that's going to incur all the trade payables and expenses. And if it's not a lease, it could be a subsidiary of the property company that's providing the operational services. And there's a couple reasons to do it. One, just from an accounting standpoint, you're going to have your own P&L for the operating company, which is like the hotel. That's the hotel business. Then you're going to have separate P&L for the real estate business. Because, you know, the easiest example, if you go out and do some CapEx work, that shouldn't really be on the hotel P&L because that's you as the owner adding to the property, doing some work. It shouldn't really impact your hotel P&L because that's kind of like one-time expenses. Let's just say you had to hire a lawyer to do something with real estate because you wanted to get some land entitled. You know, that shouldn't be on the legal expense on the hotel operating business. That should be on the legal expense in the property owner business. On the operating business, if you, I don't know, getting a lawsuit with like a vendor or something, that is going to be on the operating business P&L. Maybe you'll flag that as a one-time expense. It's important to keep the real estate expenses out of the operating business because if you were to ever sell your hotel, everyone has to do due diligence, but what they're going to look at is they're going to look at the P&L from your hotel. And you want that P&L to be as high as possible. So you want it to only be hotel expenses. And the real and think of the real estate as separate. So you want your EBITDA or your NOI to be as high as possible. And with that, you don't want like CapEx, you know, if you have to buy a new water heater, you don't want that on the hotel P&L. That's going to be on the real estate kind of P&L. So that is typically how we do all of our properties. One thing that you could do, well, let's go back. So if you have a management company, and you manage multiple hotels, that management company will have its own LLC. And, you know, Eddie, maybe you own 100% of that. and it provides services to each one of the hotels. It gets paid a management fee from the hotel to the hotel management company. All that happens on the P&L. Oh, who? James is sharing a screen.
I'm a CPA and I do this stuff all the freaking time. So
you're making it.
Draw along what you were kind of saying there, because I'm actually in the middle of restructuring my company right now to do this, because I bought it all under one LLC and I'm currently stripping out the operations, buying another hotel, implementing my management company, doing hotel management agreements. So I was jumping as you were saying it and happy to keep doing that as well.
Yeah. So keep playing around. So you have your management co, like where you were drawing that. And this management co is going to provide third-party management services to the, you want it really tied to the real estate, but that's where you're going to provide the services, whether it's the opco or the real estate co, whatever, it's going to provide the services. Now, in our company, we have 11 different properties, and because we have almost 1,000 employees, if we lump all of our employees together, we can get, you know, better health insurance as 1,000 versus like each individual property. So our employees are basically employed by a separate company, a service, an employment company. And that's where all the employment insurances and all their payroll runs through. And what happens is each hotel operating entity every 2 weeks basically sends money to that company, and that company pays all the employees for all the 11 hotels. And that's how it works. If you are really like wanted to protect your legal interest and separate things, what you can do is create a subsidiary of your management company for each hotel. So, you know, our management company is called Wurzach Hotel Group. So we would have 123 Maple Street Wurzach Hotel Group LLC. And the reason why you might do that is another further way to insulate something that could happen on a property. Maybe it's a union issue. Who knows? It could be anything from the management company. And, you know, that might be another thing you would consider. But what you're seeing on the screen, which is pretty cool, is a very, very similar way to how we set things up. The only difference is this hotel opco is not owned by the fund. It would typically be owned by like the propco. You know, maybe there's a dotted line. Depends how you do it, but that's basically how we have it set up. So, you know, Eddie, if you are looking to, let's say, maybe someone said, "Man, Eddie, you know how to do these hotels, man. I want you to manage a hotel for me because I suck." You would just sign a third-party management agreement with that group and provide management services. But all of the expenses and all the business is going to happen on their hotel operating company, not yours, not your management company. That's just you and your business. You are getting a fee every month of 4%, whatever it is, and that's it. But no hotel expenses come to our management company. All that is paid for at the hotel level. Each hotel has to sink or swim on its own. And that's how we set it up.
I feel like you mentioned kind of two structures, or maybe they're both the same. So is the operating company leasing the hotel from?
That's one way.
Okay.
Or you can basically just have it owned by the prop, have the opco owned by the propco, and it's providing a service for the propco.
And you charge a fee to the property company or to a separate?
No, the management company in our world charges a fee to the hotel opco.
Okay.
And then, you know, in reality, you kind of consolidate the hotel opco and propco at the end of the day. So you look at it, but we like to keep the operating business separate from the real estate business. So, and then this is like really nuanced, but what we do every month at all of our properties is, you know, the hotel team produces the hotel P&L. And let's just say that it showed the hotel made $1 million of net operating income. That's basically your operating company profit. Now, this would be before debt service, taxes, and insurance, because that's all paid at the PropCo. Those aren't really hotel expenses. And what we do is we actually transfer that money from the operating bank account to the real estate bank account every month. And that's how it works. So we kind of like, we leave some working capital, we kind of suck out all the money from the OpCo and put in the PropCo. And then after we pay all of our property expenses, then you distribute to your investors, your LPs. That's how it works.
Yeah, Jake, like you said, this fund LP is really the entity that captures both of these. I come from a tax background, so these entities are called disregarded for tax purposes.
Yep.
And it's all kind of reported on a consolidated basis at this fund LP level.
Yep.
And you remove like the intercompany transactions of like the lease expense, the lease income. So it nets to zero at this end of the day. But like you said, it's really nice to have the hotel operations on one P&L, get a valuation for your hotel. You know, every hotel is going to have to rent from somewhere. They're renting from you. And then you can keep the valuation of the land separate as well.
Yep, exactly. Now, in this instance, obviously, to James's point, what he has there, the fund LP, you know, it owns everything. So that's where you're consolidating at the end of the day. And you're, from a tax standpoint, this is the one that's reporting for tax purposes. But, you know, there are, like, if you've heard of Sonder, for example, like Sonder doesn't own any real estate. So they basically have a legit rental agreement and they are just the hotel opco. Now, like setting aside the business practice and whatever, that's different from this, where this is kind of like really just a fake rental agreement.
It's not the point of this call, but there's other considerations for being the actual owner and operating something, because motels would generate self-employment taxable income. And so you want to be able to structure in a way, using an S corp is usually what I like to do to help mitigate the amount of payroll taxes you're getting on the hotel side.
Yep, 100%. 100%. Alex, what's your question?
Hi, Jake. Thanks very much. I wanted to ask how you structure branded residences as well.
Yeah. So branded residences is very similar to a third-party management contract. That's basically what it is. So depending on the scope, it's a third-party management contract and a licensing agreement. So let's just say one of you guys come up with like an amazing brand. Using a big brand, St. Regis from Marriott, that brand has a lot of prestige, a great reputation, Four Seasons, even better one. So Four Seasons will license their name, their brand to certain property owners to allow them to put that on there. And for that, they'll require them to do certain things. And they might also, if they're providing services, have a management agreement in place as well. But if you're at the point where you can charge for your brand and your management company and separate those two things, that's pretty cool.
And if you're selling real estate, would that go through the PropCo or would that be a separate entity altogether?
No, that would be through the PropCo. So basically, you know, the real estate, it would be like, if maybe there's an HOA, there's some sort of board, they would continuously pay a fee to use your name, your brand on their real estate. So you would basically get constant residual income. Or maybe structure it as a one-time thing, and that's what you want. But there's a couple different options.
Jake, do you have a suggestion for a good structure if a hotel has an F&B space and it's not leased, it's going to the P&L of the hotel, but you want a third-party group to operate it for you and have some kind of, you know, sharing of either revenue or profit with them?
David, this is like the biggest mystery in the hotel world, because there have been a million different variations of this, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. I think where we're at, so it's evolved. So I would say in 2010 era, like when celebrity chefs really became pretty prominent and people wanted all these name brand people to come into their space, what the typical structure would be a management fee, and the restaurateur would get a piece off the top, and then they'd get a piece off the bottom based on profitability. And it would always be a little bit of a negotiation. Who owns and controls the employees? Is it the hotel or is it this like other entity? And in a management fee, maybe the employees are technically employed by the hotel, but they're really under the control of this other management company that's layering on top and getting a fee for that. And the big problem there is there's oftentimes a big misalignment of interest, because the management company would make a decent fee off the top line revenue, but the restaurant might lose a ton of money. Or this F&B person is so concerned about their brand and their reputation that they don't really care about making money. They shouldn't make the top line money. So then they're just spending like crazy. And now the hotel has to absorb all of these costs and it becomes a huge loss leader. And in a hotel, the food and beverage is always, you know, the smaller component of the rooms, or at least it should be, or else you're not really a hotel. So in a lot of hotels, it could be 80-20, 70-30. You know, maybe if you have a lot of F&B, it's 60-40. But where I think a lot of groups have evolved is hotels, if they're going to bear the risk of the expense, they want the control. Meaning the general manager has to have the ability to come in and be like, I don't care if your name is Mario Batali or, you know, whatever. Listen, your expenses are crazy. You don't need 50 chefs in the kitchen. Like, we got to chill out with this. And here's how we're going to restaff it. So what Four Seasons has started to do recently, because they have a lot of like destination type restaurants in their hotels, is either two things: a straight lease where it's just like a retail tenant. And, you know, maybe there's some nuances because they're inside the hotel, whatever. Or what they're doing is like a consulting agreement. And I really like this because restaurants are fucking hard, man. Like, it is the hardest business in the world. If you think hotels are hard, restaurants are even harder, and you make less money most likely. So what a consulting deal looks like is you take all the great ideas from this restaurant entrepreneur, everything, the recipes, the concept, the design, you know, what kind of plates they want, what kind of uniforms the staff is going to wear, how they might schedule and set up the kitchen. They kind of get you started, but you are responsible for all that whole P&L. So the hotel is responsible. So if the hotel makes money, great. If the hotel loses money, they own the whole thing. And then whatever is negotiated every month, every quarter, the group comes back and kind of helps and revamps things, or maybe they change some items on the menu. And that, I think, is a really great relationship because you're, you know, you get what you pay for. And if you don't like the consultant, then you could move to someone else. But that's been a really good approach, because then as the hotel person, you get to keep the food and beverage in-house and have control over that. Well, David, you might say like, I don't want the F&B. Like, I have this great hotel, I'm making a ton of money on this great hotel, but my guests want F&B. I just don't want to be a restaurant operator or a bar operator. Being a bar operator is okay. The part of F&B is much harder. But let's just say you don't want to do that. Well, maybe you kind of build out the space and you come up with a lease structure that so you can get paid back for the space build out, but they're basically providing that amenity for the guest, paying you kind of a rent. And if it's a home run, they keep all the upside. Maybe there's a sharing, but that's another way to do it. It depends how involved you like to be. In our company, we do all the F&B ourselves. So we don't have any people that we bring in and do F&B. But what we have brought in is consultants on a as-needed basis. And that's because we like F&B. We know it. But we're not the best guys at F&B. Like, we're not. But we can do F&B, we think, really well and make money.
So is the consulting a fixed fee then?
It could be a variety of different things. It could be a fixed fee. It could be an ongoing fee. There could be a percentage. That would be cool. I mean, I would do a percentage with a consultant because then they feel more ownership in the business or in the opportunity. But you have a defined scope and a defined fee. So it's very easy to calculate. And you should, if you want the person to come back, you know, every quarter or whatever, then, you know, you should understand what those costs are. And like, yeah, you're going to have to pick up travel and hotel and all that stuff, but you know, you should agree to that up front. Now there could be a licensing component to that, but I don't know how much those are really worth. So I don't know that there's a lot of value in licensing it, but then you kind of running it yourself.
What do you think about just leasing it out to a restaurant operator instead of a consulting agreement?
Yeah, I think that's great. That'd be the option where like you don't want to have anything to do with it. And you think someone else is going to make way more money than you're going to make. I love that option. There's a couple things that you need to think about. Most restaurant operators don't want to do three meals. They don't want to do breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Most hotels need breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Maybe your hotel doesn't, so then it's like, fine. But, or maybe you do the breakfast and they do the lunch and dinner. So you have to really figure out if what you need can be solved through a lease. And a lot of the times it can be. Another thing that you want to really think through is the design of the space, the food. Like, let's just say their restaurant concept, you lease the space, but then their restaurant concept, you know, blows up and is terrible. And then they want to launch a new concept and that's like a Burger King. Well, if you have this like cool hotel, you don't really want like a crappy Burger King in your hotel. So you want to have parameters around what they can do and maybe what your approval rights are. And it also is very like city dependent. Like, let's just say, I don't know, you're going into Austin. There's like two restaurant guys in Austin that just crush it, that do a great job. And you want to get a lot of the momentum that they're bringing from their other restaurants into your property. That might be even more motivation to lease the space to them.
What about it, like integrating the one, if you have a lease space, it seems like it would be difficult to get them on the same page in terms of like your guests can go and just put it on their room and everything's seamless.
That gets murky, I would say, when you have a lease space, that gets very murky. So if you have a lease space, what I'd recommend, and it's not really honestly that big of a deal, is, you know, you just can't charge it to your room. Like everyone has a credit card now, it's not that big of a deal. If you have to charge the room, okay, you know, everything's digital now, it's auditable, but sometimes like the system that they're using in the restaurant may not link to your hotel POS system, and there might be more work from an accounting standpoint than it's actually worth. I mean, a perfect example is like this Moxie Hotel in St. Pete. We have Sparrow, the rooftop restaurant. We have Roses, the coffee shop, and then we have like a lobby bar. But there's a retail kind of building which we own next door, and we lease that space. Like, I could have done a restaurant there, but like, I don't want to do a restaurant. The only reason I'm doing these restaurants is to enhance the hotel. That's a standalone restaurant. I don't need to do that restaurant. There's someone else that's going to do a fine job there. I don't want to do that. So it really depends on the goals and the business plan. But if you have like a remote hotel, you're probably going to need to do the F&B yourself because there's no one else that's going to do it for you. But if you come into a city, it's very easy to get someone to do the restaurant for you and take that off your hands. There's no like right or wrong answer. A lot of people have struggled with it. A lot of hotel restaurants have failed because of bad structures, not because of bad food.
Jake, are you going to the IMN Family Office Conference in Coral Gables this month?
I was thinking about it, actually. Maybe I should go. But are you going?
Yeah, I'll be in town.
Okay. Yeah, I need to relook at it because we had our calendar as a potential. Those conferences, you know, can be pretty good, but, actually I think what we said to them is, we'll go if we can speak because, you know, we're in capital raise mode right now. So part of the benefit is also getting the visibility as a speaker because you're more likely to, you know, connect with folks as opposed to just being an audience member. So I don't know. We'll see. Maybe if they have me. Sonia, what do you got?
I am working on a hotel in Mexico specifically, and right now at the stage of hiring construction management firm. I've gotten really good recommendations through the network from family offices specifically. And I'm trying to figure out what the right way to think about the right incentive structure to set for these contracts. The construction management company, the scope that I'd be bringing them on for is pre-construction estimates overall, project management, as well as construction management throughout the project. And I know there's a whole slew of different models when it comes down to how their services are charged. But I want to just zoom out and get your perspective on setting up the right incentive structure when it comes down to what they should be charging and what I should be asking for.
Great question. So I'm going to answer it assuming you have enough capital and you don't have to kind of be entrepreneurial and like crazy about figuring out just like the most basic structure. So for pre-construction services, in my opinion, that should be a flat fee because, you know, they're a professional firm. They can figure generally based on your plans, how much time and effort they're going to spend. And that should be a flat fee. Oftentimes I will ask them to kind of eat that fee or like roll it in as like a discount or heavily discounted if we decide to use them as the construction manager. The construction management fee should be a percentage fee off of their work performed. And they will also try and charge you what's called general conditions and general requirements. You can, you know, Google what these are, but like the simplest way to think about it is general conditions are like their cost to complete your job, including payroll, you know, air travel, like a trailer on the job site. And then general requirements are like similar stuff, but it's just like a different category. It might be things like tools they need, like equipment they have to buy, different things like that. And those should all be identified by them based on the total cost of the project. And oftentimes we will do what's called a guaranteed max price contract, GMP. Also known as a GMP, meaning guaranteed minimum price contract. So the joke there is that, you know, no plans are perfect. Contractors are always going to hit you with a change order. That GMP might eventually become a guaranteed minimum price. So within that GMP, assuming nothing changes, their general conditions and their general requirements, unless you cause a delay or unless like the natural environment causes a delay, are basically fixed. Meaning like if it takes them longer to build the building because they're disorganized, that's their problem. If it takes them longer to build the building because you can't pick any of the materials or, you know, there's a hurricane and they had to delay their job, then, you know, that's different and you probably pick that up. There's also what's commonly referred to as a shared savings. So in a GMP concept where they're giving you, we're going to build this hotel for you for $10 million. If throughout the process, they're able to negotiate with their subs for a bigger amount than they thought, and it only costs $9.5 million, then you would share that $500,000 of savings. It's negotiable, but like 50-50, 60-40, it depends, right? If you have a budget of $10 million and they're coming to you with a $10.5 million GMP, then maybe you say, hey, I want to do a $10 million GMP, but I'll give you 70-30 on the shared savings. So, you know, they're taking some risk, but then you're giving them a lot of upside actually if they end up coming in less. And then the one thing you didn't really ask, but like there's something called an owner's rep. So, you know, Sony, you're like the smartest construction person there is, but maybe you're not, or maybe you don't have the ability to be on site all the time. So you could hire an owner's rep, which would basically represent you as the owner with the contractor, looking out for your interests, being on site, all this kind of stuff. And that typically I've seen as a flat fee.
Well,
because like if it's a company, they know what their cost of people are and they can make a profit on top of that. Or if it's an individual, he knows what, or she knows what her time is worth and can charge accordingly.
Makes sense. The GMP, I'm assuming that like when you're at construction documents, that's when you're specifically negotiating that.
I would say 50% construction documents is when you want to have, you know, one round of GMP pricing, and then you go in for your final at like 95%. You know, the mistake we always make, and most people make, is they like bid out the plans before they're fully done, because they're just, they want to get started, their debt service is costing them money, you know, oh, we'll figure it out. And if you do that in your GMP, you build in what's called allowances, and the allowances are at your discretion for the owner. It's different from a contingency, which is actually typically like the discretion of the contractor, or it's like a, the owner might have to agree, but the allowance is like fully your number. So you can make the allowance whatever you want. If you think it's going to cost $1 million, make the allowance $1 million. If you think it's going to cost $5 million, make it $5 million. And that'll be in there, and you can use that allowance how you like. So that could be one way, but like the cleanest way is to have all your interior designs, all your construction drawings, all your landscape, everything done, and let them price it. And by the way, like someone put on the chat that they're a developer in Baja Sur. So maybe you guys can link up.
So question, I'm thinking about either raising capital or co-sponsoring for a deal outside of Zion National Park. It's going to play in the space between like upscale glamping that maybe costs $500 a night and like the Amangiris of the world, which at a high level, I think there's a ton of white space there. I think there's a lot of demand for like a $1,300 a night hotel, that is like luxurious, but not, maybe not as high touch or high programming as like an Amangiri. I guess my specific question is like the other sponsors on the deal are first time operators. And so they have like, they've got good real estate development experience. They've dabbled in different types of hospitality, like an Airbnb hotel. And what I like about them is they're very, they're aware of their shortcomings, and they're willing to surround themselves with the talent they need in terms of mentors, advisors, third-party management company, designers, like essentially to fill the gaps that they don't have. But I'm just curious, like if you were to look at a deal like that, is there a way for you to get comfortable with a project like that with someone who has not done a similar deal before?
Probably, but that would require us to be like the strategic partner. You know, the, you know, we might have to be playing a more active role. We looked at a deal kind of like that, and the person had like no management experience. They had some good ideas. They had land. They'd made some progress. And we looked at it as more of a co-GP type of thing where we knew we had to get involved, but the person was coming with value that they would create and that they had created. It wasn't like, oh, I make these beautiful renderings and pay this guy on Fiverr to draw all this shit, but I really don't have anything. Like, they had something. The other thing that would be a requirement for us is the management. So, you know, Airbnb hotel is nothing like $1,300 a night hotel. Like $1,300 a night hotel is Four Seasons. That's real hotel. Mm-hmm. So you can get around that by hiring a third party manager, though, for sure. And making sure you don't get taken, which is why maybe a strategic partner or someone that's been through it before, you know, could get involved. But that would be critical. We'd definitely be weary of, you know, unless it's like the most amazing, I don't know. We definitely be weary of it. But like, I also don't think you can just like hire an amazing manager, like a general manager, and then have him kind of run the show if you really don't know. Because when you're trying to charge that amount of ADR, there's no room for error. Mm-hmm. And if you were maybe charging a little bit less, you could make a few more mistakes. You have some margin for error. But at that level, people are going to require like and demand real services and expertise. And there's also a business behind it. You know, I've got, you know, like 5 people on my hotel accounting team that are off property, like have nothing to do with the hotel properties. And then we have 1 or 2 people at each hotel. So we probably have like 20 people in accounting, and it's just for the operating company. Then for the real estate, we have like 5 people in accounting. So there's a lot of like back office stuff, like HR and like our GMs at our hotels are not just like off on their own. You know, you really have to have the most entrepreneurial GM that understands all the other parts of the business other than just delivering service if you're just going to be relying on that one guy.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that has to be his motivation. Maybe, you know, maybe he's the best GM in the world, but he's not the best at like managing a revenue strategy or a sales strategy or HR and accounting, which is like all the stuff you need, or social media.
Yeah. Okay. I totally get that.
Yeah. But it's completely solvable. Like every single Auberge Hotel, which is an amazing brand, every single Four Seasons is not owner operated. They are owned by someone else and operated by one of those brands because they're a pro.
Yeah. And I think that's their plan. They have in their deck Coral Tree as is just someone that they've talked to about managing. I don't know if you're familiar, but if they're not set up.
Yeah. Rob Lowe was on the podcast. Rob Lowe owns Coral Tree, but he owns Lowe Real Estate. So he's a great friend of mine. And Coral Tree is a great manager.
Okay, cool. And then quick follow-up question is, so they're also going to do residences?
That would, to me, then it's like, oh, okay. Like, then I'd be like, oh, well.
Okay.
I want to make sure that like they're listening to them and they're, you know, involved in the design and the development and stuff. Because a lot of non-hotel people don't get also construction, how to build a hotel. If you are building a hotel for the first time, you're just going to make a ton of mistakes. Mm-hmm. You know, still make mistakes. And we're on like hotel building 11 or something. So make a lot less mistakes than we did on number one, though.
Yeah, one of the co-sponsors is a developer. And I think like they would work with Coral Tree and an on-site construction schedule. Yeah. So that's how I kind of got comfortable with it at a high level. One quick follow-up question. So they're also going to do residences to, you know, boost the return profile. It seems like it's a good approach. Do you see any challenges if I were to raise capital just for the hotel side? Like, is that dangerous? I'm just trying to think if, like, as an example, they're offering free hotel amenities to residence owners, which is negatively impacting the hotel P&L, but not the overall.
Roll it away as fast as you can.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. So you would say either.
Well, like, you know, they're basically, they're here. They're going to be like, we're going to make all the money on the real estate and we're going to find some shill to own this hotel that's going to be saddled with all the expenses. And then we're already out because we own the real estate, but these people are stuck with the hotel, which can never make any money because it's providing services for everyone who bought the real estate and the hotel never profited. So the best example of that in Miami is the Viceroy Miami on Brickell, which, you know, went bankrupt two or three times. It's owned by a Abu Dhabi investor, I think now. And the problem with that deal is the agreement between the hotel and the condo residence is so messed up that the hotel can never really make money because it's subsidizing so much cost. So you really have to have a very shared agreement. I also don't think, like, you know, you said to me, oh, well, these guys are doing the residences to boost the return profile. So it's like, then why am I going to get stuck with the hotel? Like, I want my profile to be boosted, you know? So I got to be in the whole deal. It just creates, you know, misaligned incentives.
Yeah. Okay. So you're not saying run from the deal as a whole. You're just saying run from the deal if you're only
run from that idea, but not the deal. Yeah. And Coral Tree also knows how to operate, you know, residential pools and all this kind of stuff. So for a lot of the reasons that makes sense, but the reason to do residences is to make the hotel numbers, you know, kind of make sense because to these 5-star hotels, like, it probably doesn't really pencil if you have like a normal time horizon or you don't have some legacy that you're trying to build. So to be excluded from that would be pretty bad, I think.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Super helpful. Thank you.
Yeah. Great question.
So I am like a brand new entrepreneur to this. I want to open up a micro resort with a hot spring on it. And my question is for first-time entrepreneurs, what's the number one reason they fail and why?
Where are you right now?
You're like in a cool spot. I'm Antigua, it's really cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm a travel concierge and my client hired me to be the photographer for their trip that I planned for them. So
that's amazing.
Yeah.
Where are you?
Antigua.
Wow. Antigua has overwater bungalows like that?
Yeah. This one's okay. Like the top two resorts were all booked out. So this is the one I had to pick, but it's okay.
Very cool. I think the most common mistake entrepreneurs make are not understanding risk and surrounding themselves with bad people that may have more knowledge than they do.
So for like not understanding risk, like, do you mean like with more capital or?
Yeah. So like, it depends. So if you're like just general entrepreneurs, you know, they don't understand the risk, but like, if we're talking about like building this hot springs resort.
Yeah. So I'll give you more information on it. I might be putting an offer on this property in Wyoming. It's an hour south of Jackson. It's in the Star Valley area. So my main concern is it's too far away from Jackson. Because I want to have like a farm to table restaurant and like snowmobiling. There's fly fishing nearby. My initial like phase one would be just 10 cabins that have a kitchenette. And then as I make money, introduce that restaurant, because there's a geothermally heated greenhouse that has citrus trees, microgreens, all that. And then I can like contact like local farmers and get anything else I need from Salt Lake City, which is 3.5 hours away. But I'm like, is it too far? Or
so I don't you know. Are thinking about risk, because someone not thinking about risk would say, I'm going to do 50 cabins and we're going to build this huge restaurant. And, you know, I'm not going to do the cabins out of wood and stuff because that doesn't look cool. I'm going to do them like tents. And, you know, you build your 50 cabins and you realize it's freaking cold in Jackson, Wyoming, and there's no insulation. Everyone's freezing. So that's, you know, not understanding risk. And I think, you know, also having optionality is key. So if you're going to do 10 little cabins, well, let's just say like you decide that there's only demand for 10 cabins and there's no need for a restaurant, then don't build the restaurant. And you have a great little business, maybe you're running these 10 cabins, maybe you sell the 10 cabins, maybe you figure out how to automate them so you don't even have to have all this labor to deal with it. Or you can scale up, but that is thinking about risk. When you said, hey, I'm not sure if my location is right. I looked at a deal today that someone bought. This guy I used to know, I was just kind of checking out what he was up to. And he bought this hotel and like, hotel is in a terrible location. Location, location, location is so important. And timing is also so important.
Yeah. The problem with the, like what I want, I'm like a purist with hot spring water. So they're very remote. So it's not like I'm going to be 30 minutes from a city. Like a lot of these things are 4 hours.
If I care about hot springs, then I would think the same way you think. And I wouldn't be worried about driving an hour and a half from a city or from an airport, because that's what you have to do to go to these amazing places. Want you to kind of spend all this, build out this massive thing before you have like a proof of concept. Or maybe you decide like, actually, I don't really need, for whatever reason, a restaurant like I originally thought. Maybe I want to build more cabins.
Yeah. That's a good point. And
I think generally restaurants and food and beverage are important. I actually think a lot of mistakes that people potentially could make with a micro resort is they haven't thought about food and beverage.
Yeah. And I think having food and beverage is so important. And like my idea for the initial 10 cabins would be they have a kitchenette so people can cook, because I do want to have the option to expand. This is a 75 acre property. I'm 26. I don't have too much capital. Like I have like $1.5 million. So I need investors and stuff. So it's also really hard for me to get those other investors, being so young, not having too much experience, which I'm trying to build. I'm actually going to go work at this hotel on Singer Island called Omrit Resort. It's a wellness hotel. They're going to give me an internship. But I don't know if you have any other advice.
Our former food and beverage director, one of our hotels, works at that hotel. And actually, I think they took a couple of people from our hotel.
What's their name? I'm meeting Dilip on the 21st. So
who is that? The owner?
That's the owner.
Okay.
And Viceroy owns that. And Highgate does their hiring process.
Highgate does the management. So Highgate is the third party manager, I think, right?
What did you, can you repeat that?
Is Highgate the third party manager?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, my friend runs Highgate too. So, but back to your question, you know, maybe what you evolve is like, we want to have a farm stand out on this thing and people cook their own food, or we're going to have kind of a family meal dinner. Like maybe it's a different food and beverage concept than what you originally thought. But okay, you're thinking about it, you don't need to have a, like you could still be successful without a restaurant, which is great.
Yeah. Maybe I'll, if you don't mind, maybe I'll send you an email later on and ask a little bit more about that.
Send me an email. So if you're thinking about stuff like that, Rock Creek Ranch is one of the best food, like glamping kind of things out there. Brush Creek Ranch is another one.
I've heard of that one. Have you heard of Sage Lodge in Montana?
No.
Okay. That's a comparable property to me. And then also Dunton Hot Springs is the most comparable property. Yep. Because it's an hour from Telluride, so it's sticky and they're hard to get to.
I'm not worried about being an hour from it. If someone is looking to get away, that's what they want. I'm not really worried about that. I'd be more worried if you drove an hour and you were in the middle of a big desert and there was nothing to look at.
Yeah, no, this is like, it's really beautiful. But when I pitch to investors, the number one thing they say to me is, oh, it's too far. It's too far, which I disagree with because I've been doing a lot of research. Like I went on, funny enough, I went on TikTok and I looked up Jackson vlogs. And in almost every single Jackson vlog, there's evidence of people driving to Granite Creek or Granite Hot Springs, which is 57-minute drive. So I was like, if they drive to there, they're going to drive to me.
Yeah, I'm not drive to destiny. I mean, if you just Google drive to or have ChatGPT do, I mean, drive to travel is like the biggest thing. You know, Maine, that's what it's all about. Amangiri, I'm like sick of the example, but that is impossible to get to. That's like 4 hours away.
I mean, it is.
These places are very remote. And the other thing you have to think about is you're talking about 10 or 20 cabins. Like that's nothing. Okay.
Yeah.
Talking about building a 500 room convention center hotel in the middle of nowhere. Yeah. Then it's hard to get to that. Doesn't make any sense, but you've got to sell 10 rooms.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to find 10 people drive that far.
Yeah. I want to start with 10 and they'll be like spread out. And then they'll all have their own private hot spring. That way people can do their own thing.
Awesome.
Yeah. I'll send you an email about it. Cause
yeah. But another thing is like, you know, look up how close you are to state or national parks.
I did. So it's what people hitting the east entrance of Yellowstone will drive right past me because it's right off Highway 89, about 5 minutes. And then there's also the Grand Tetons. People just drive to Jackson to ski. So people are going to pass me. And the Star Valley Ranch area is actually, it's growing because I'm sorry, all my terminology is not the best, but I got this like economic study and like people are moving there like to buy their second homes and things like that.
That's what you say when someone says it's too far.
That's what I've been saying. And they're like, it's too far. I'm like, just don't get it.
Talk to your people.
Okay. Thank you.
Keep it up.
Hey, I'm in the middle of getting a liquor license for my little 10 key boutique lodge that I redeveloped. And just kind of any best practices on that. Like, I really want to focus on having it like be an events musical center. We do farmers markets on Sundays. We've been bringing in like catered breweries have been selling booze there lately, but just any ideas of on starting to implement an F&B plan minus the F, because like you, I've never wanted to own a restaurant ever. It's a really hard business, like you said, but the B side is too profitable to ignore.
Yeah. Where are you? Like, where's the location?
I'm in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. A AAA location downtown.
Okay. You know, the B part is amazing. And I think every hotel should have a great bar. So that bar could be just a single person, single bartender thing. And you have to figure out what would do best there. Is that like a mixology focused bar? Is that more of a beer place? You know, what is it? And the other thing you could do is like, you could serve chips and you could serve nuts and olives and those little things. Or maybe there's some like crudité, like not real food, but like just stuff for you to have out there. I've also seen someone that, and I don't totally like this, I'm just saying it, but if you felt like you needed food, like you could have a food truck pull up and be there for whatever event you were having or whatever you were doing. But I just love the idea of doing a really cool bar, and you could do like special stuff. Like you could do tequila classes and margarita classes and things like that. And it would be a lot of fun. And you just got to find a great bartender, a great mixologist. And you want this person, like a Cheers bar, to like make the whole thing, to know every guest by their name. They're basically like an ambassador. The other thing you could do is, you know, potentially like, I don't know if you have like a lobby or some sort of area, like a main house or something, but like,
it's like a motel, and like I have a shed that I'm going to turn into like the bar. And
you have a pool, or it's like the weather's not right for it?
No pool.
You want outside people to come in, or is it just hotel guests?
It's a really, really bad location for a bar. Honestly, it's like down and behind a garden. I can share my screen again and kind of show you.
Yeah, show it to me.
So this is our farmer's market site plan. And so I own this vacant lot next to our motel parcel where people park. We have parking right here. This white building is our motel. And then you see this ingress egress line here. This is like the driveway ramp down to this huge, like 1 acre beautiful garden area where we have our farmer's markets. So my original idea was like, call this like the yard bar, serve people out of the shed, which is right here. And then maybe turn this into a music venue as well. Let me see if I can get some pictures of this.
But it seems like you want more than just hotel guests to come to it.
Yeah, I want it to be more of like an event space than an actual bar, if that makes sense.
But you're going to have to program the events. You don't want people renting the space out from you, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, you know, band, DJ, all that kind of stuff. But there's an example here. It's a famous bar. It's called Broken Shaker in Miami. They were kind of like, it was like in a garden and of the Freehand Hotel. And it became an award-winning bar, and it was very kind of backyard patio style. And to me, you know, obviously this is Miami, totally different vibe and energy. But to me, this, there's a lot of similarities here of things that you can kind of do.
Yeah. There's another like lodge in Montana. I think it's called like Pine Creek Lodge or something. Does something super similar. I got to go check out and learn from them.
But I think you have to figure out, you know, what you want to be and what you want to do and create the energy that will draw people in. One way that we've had success doing that is making sure like you find people, like maybe it's a band that has a following or a DJ that has a following, so that you can hire them to provide entertainment. But then, you know, they're also bringing some people with them as well.
Yeah. My garden can look exactly like this with all these trees around, some string lights on stage. That's what I'm going to try to really drive towards.
I think you should. I think it's awesome. I'm just looking, like a friend of mine owns this little like cabin kind of thing called the Captain Whitby Hotel. It's like Whitby, W-H-I-D-B-E-Y.
On Whitby Island.
Yeah. Let me see if I can pull it up right here. You have it, but here, I'll show you. So, but like, look at this little bar that he has. Right. Like, this is like, you know, inside, but you can create like these really cool spaces.
Yeah. I have a meeting with my architects in 3 hours to go over exactly all this. So
and you could be something like with a, it could be a beer garden too. One of the most successful places in New York is called the Standard Beer Garden.
Oh yeah. I've stayed there.
Standard Hotel.
Yeah.
Place pumps. But you could get like a trailer and, you know, clad it in wood or whatever, something cool, and just serve right out of that thing. Right outside. So it's pretty cool. But this is fun, guys. I gotta hop. I know we have a couple. Sorry I didn't get to everyone, but we'll do it again. The Q&A seemed like a lot of fun. So let's do it and keep crushing it. Let me know if I can ever help.
Loved it, Jake. Thanks for coming.
Have a great day, guys. See ya.
Hey everyone, it's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter at Jay Wurzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Wurzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.